At a gesture from old Sangani, Moses Gama strode up the slope to the entrance of the kraal, and Victoria rose to her feet to meet him. They faced each other, and once again a silence fell. The guests were awed by this couple, the groom so tall and commanding, the bride beautiful and nubile. Involuntarily, they craned forward as Victoria unclipped the uku string of beads from around her waist. This was the symbol of her virginity, and she knelt before Moses, and with both hands cupped in the formal and polite gesture, she offered him the beads. As he accepted her and her gift, a great shout went up from the guests. It was done. Moses Gama was her husband and her master at last. Now the feasting and the beer drinking could begin in earnest, and the raw red meat was heaped upon the coals and snatched off again barely singed, while the beer pots passed from hand to hand, and the young girls went swinging down the slope, bearing fresh pots upon their heads. Suddenly there was an uproar, and a band of plumed warriors came dashing up the slope towards where Victoria sat at the kraal entrance. They were her brothers and half-brothers and nephews, even Joseph Dinizulu was amongst them, and they shouted their war cries as they came to rescue their sister from the stranger who would take her from their midst. However, the buffaloes were ready for them, and with Hendrik at their head and sticks whistling and hissing, they rushed in to prevent the abduction. The women wailed and ululated, and the fighting sticks clattered and whacked on flesh, and the warriors howled and circled and charged at each other in a fine mist of dust. It was for this that all metal weapons were strictly banned from the ceremony. For the fighting, which was at first playful, soon heated up, and blood dripped and bones cracked before the abductors allowed themselves to be driven off. The blood was staunched with a handful of dust clapped on the wound, and both victors and vanquished had worked up a fine thirst and shouted to the girls to bring more beer. The uproar subsided for only a few minutes, to be resumed almost immediately, as from the top of the slope came the rumble of motor cars. The children raced up the hill and began to clap and sing as two big motor cars appeared over the brow and came bumping slowly over the rough track that led to the kraal. In the leading vehicle was a large white woman, with a red face as lined and craggy as that of a bulldog, and a wide-brimmed, old-fashioned hat on her head, from under which grey hair curled untidily. "Who is she?" Moses demanded. "Lady Anna Courtney," Victoria exclaimed. "She was the one who encouraged me to leave here and go into the world." Impulsively, Victoria ran forward to meet the vehicle, and when Lady Anne descended ponderously, she embraced her. "So, my child, you've come back to us." Lady Anna's accent was still thick, though she had lived 35 years in Africa. "Not for long," Victoria laughed, and Lady Anna looked at her fondly. Once the child had served in the big house as one of her housemaids, until her bright beauty and intelligence had convinced Lady Anna that she was superior to such menial work. "Where is this man who is taking you away?" she demanded, and Victoria took her hand. "First you must greet my father, then I will introduce you to my husband." From the second motor car, a middle-aged couple climbed down to be enthusiastically greeted by the crowd and pressed forward around them. The man was tall and dapper, with the bearing of a soldier. He was tanned by the sun, and his eyes had the faraway look of the outdoor man. He twirled his moustaches and took his wife on his arm. She was almost as tall and even slimmer than he was, and despite the streaks of grey in her hair, she was still an unusually handsome woman. Sangani Dinizulu came to greet them. "I see you, Jamela." His dignity was somewhat tempered by a happy grin of welcome, and Colonel Mark Anders answered him in perfect colloquial Zulu. "I see you, old man." The term was one of respect. "May all your cattle and all your wives grow fat and sleek." Sangani turned to his wife, Storm, who was the daughter of old General Sean Courtney. "I see you, Nkosikasi. You bring honour to my kraal." The bond between the two families was like steel. It went back to another century and had been tested 1,000 times. "Oh, Sangani, I'm so happy for you this day, and for Victoria." Storm left her husband and went quickly to embrace the Zulu girl. I wish you joy and many fine sons, Vicky, she told her. And Victoria answered, I owe you and your family so much, Nkosikasi. I will never be able to repay you. Don't ever try, Storm told her with mock severity. I feel as though my own daughter is getting married today. Introduce us to your husband, Vicky. Now Moses Garma came towards them, and then Storm greeted him in Zulu. He replied gravely in English, How do you do, Mrs. Anders? Victoria has spoken of you and your family very often. When at last he turned to Mark Anders, he proffered his right hand. How do you do, Colonel? Moses asked, and a wry smile flitted across his lips as he saw the white man hesitate momentarily before accepting the handshake. It was unusual for men to greet each other thus across the dividing line of colour, and despite his fluency in the language and his pretended affection for the Zulu people, Moses recognised this man. Colonel Mark Anders was an anachronism, a son of the English Queen Victoria, a soldier who had fought in two world wars and the warden of Sharkers Gate National Park, which he had saved from the poachers and despoilers by dedication and sheer bloody-mindedness, and made into one of Africa's most celebrated wildlife sanctuaries. He loved the wild animals of Africa with a kind of paternal passion, protecting and cherishing them. And to only a slightly less degree, his attitude towards the black tribes, especially the Zulus, was the same, paternalistic and condescending. By this definition, he was the mortal enemy of Moses Garma. And as they looked into each other's eyes, they both recognized this fact. I have heard the lion roar from afar, Mark Anders said in Zulu. Now I meet the beast face to face. I have heard of you as well, Colonel, Moses replied, pointedly speaking English. Victoria is a gentle child, Mark Anders persisted in his use of Zulu. We all hope you will not teach her your fierce ways. She will be a dutiful wife, Moses said in English. She will do what I ask of her, I am sure. Storm had been following the exchange, sensing the innate hostility between the two men, and now she intervened smoothly. If you are ready, Moses, we can all go down to Tunis Kraal for the ceremony. Victoria and her mother had insisted on a Christian ceremony to reinforce the traditional tribal wedding. Now Sangani and most of the other guests who were pagan and ancestor worshippers remained at the kraal while the diminishing bridal party crowded into the two motor vehicles. Tunis Kraal was the home of Lady Anna Courtney and the original seat of the Courtney family. It stood amongst its sprawling lawns and unruly gardens of palms and bougainvillea and Pride of India trees at the foot of the Ladyburg escarpment. It was a rambling old building of oddly assorted architectural styles, and beyond the gardens stretched endless fields of sugarcane that dipped and undulated to the breeze like the swells of the ocean. The wedding party trooped into the house to change into garb more suitable than beads and furs and feathers for the second ceremony, while Lady Anna and the family went to greet the Anglican priest in the marquee that had been set up on the front lawn. When the bridegroom and his attendants came out to the lawns half an hour later, they wore dark lounge suits, and Victoria's elder brother, who had pranced and swirled his plumes in the gear just a few hours before, now wore his Law Association tie in an impeccable Windsor knot and aviator-style dark glasses against the glare of Tunis Kraal's whitewashed walls, as he chatted affably with the Courtney family while they waited for the bride. Victoria's mother was decked out in one of Lady Anna's cast-off caftans, for the two ladies were of similar build, and she was already sampling the fare that was laid out on the long trestle table in the marquee. Colonel Mark Anders and the Anglican priest stood a little aside from the main group, men of the same generation. They both found the proceedings disquieting and unnatural. It had taken all Storm's powers to persuade the priest to perform the ceremony, and then he had only agreed on condition that the wedding was not held in his own church in the village, where his conservative white congregation might take offence. "Damned if we weren't all a sight better off in the old days, when everybody knew their place, instead of trying to ape their betters," Mark Anders grumbled, and the priest nodded. "Well, no sense in looking for trouble." He broke off as Victoria came out onto the wide veranda. Storm Anders had helped her select her full-length white satin wedding dress, with a wreath of tiny red tea roses holding the long veil in place around her brow. The contrast of red and white against her dark and glossy skin was striking, and her joy was infectious. Even Mark Anders forgot his misgivings for the moment, as Lady Anna at the piano struck up the wedding march. At her father's kraal, Victoria's family had built a magnificent new hut for her nuptial night. Her brothers and half-sisters had cut the wattle saplings and the trunk for the central post and plaited the stripped green branches into the shape of the beehive. Then her mother and sisters and half-sisters had done the women's work of thatching, carefully combing the long grass stems and lacing crisp bundles onto the wattle framework, packing and trimming and weaving them until the finished structure was smooth and symmetrical and the brushed grass stems shone like polished brass. Everything the hut contained was new, from the three-legged pot to the lamp and the blankets and the magnificent kaross of hyrax and monkey skins, which was the gift of Victoria's sisters, lovingly tanned and sewn by them into a veritable work of art. At the cooking fire in the centre of the hut, Victoria worked alone, preparing the first meal for her husband, while she listened to the shouted laughter of the guests outside in the night. The millet beer was mild. However, the women had brewed hundreds of gallons, and the guests had been drinking since early morning. Now she heard the bridegroom's party approaching the hut. There was singing and loud suggestive advice, cries of encouragement and rude exhortations to duty, and then Moses Garmer stooped through the entrance. He straightened and stood tall over her, his head brushing the curved roof, and outside the voices of his comrades retreated and dwindled. Still kneeling, Victoria sat back on her heels and looked up at him. Now at last she had discarded her Western clothing and wore for the last time the short beaded skirt of the Virgin. In the soft ruddy light of the fire, her naked upper body had the stark patina of antique amber. "You are very beautiful," he said, for she was the very essence of Nguni womanhood. He came to her and took her hands and lifted her to her feet. "I have prepared food for you," she whispered huskily. "There will be time later to eat." He led her to the piled kaross, and she stood submissively while he untied the thong of her apron and then lifted her in his arms and laid her on the bed of soft fur. As a girl, she had played the games with the boys in the reed banks beside the waterhole and out on the open grassy felt, where she had gone with the other girls to gather firewood conveniently close to where the cattle were being herded. These games of touching and exploring, of rubbing and fondling, right up to the forbidden act of intromission, were sanctioned by tribal custom and smiled at by the elders. But none of them had fully prepared her for the power and skill of this man, or for the sheer magnificence of him. He reached deeply into her body and touched her very soul, so that much later in the night she clung to him and whispered, "Now I am more than just your wife. I am your slave to the end of my days." In the dawn her joy was blighted, and though her lovely moon face remained serene, she wept within when he told her, "There will only be one more night, on the road back to Johannesburg. Then I must leave you." "For how long?" she asked. "Until my work is done," he replied. Then his expression softened and he stroked her face. "You knew that it must be so. I warned you this when you married me. I warned you that you were marrying the struggle." "You warned me," she agreed in a husky whisper. "But there was no way that I could guess at the agony of your leaving." They rose early the following morning. Moses had acquired a second-hand Buick, old and shabby enough not to excite interest or envy. But one of Hendrik Tabaka's expert mechanics had overhauled the engine and tightened the suspension, leaving the exterior untouched. In it they would return to Johannesburg. Though the sun had not yet risen, the entire kraal was astir, and Victoria's sisters had prepared breakfast for them. After they had eaten came the hard part of taking leave of her family. She knelt before her father. "Go in peace, my daughter," he told her fondly. "We will think of you often. Bring your sons to visit us." Victoria's mother wept and keened, as though it were a funeral, not a wedding, and Victoria could not comfort her, although she embraced her and protested her love and duty until the other daughters took her away. Then there were all her stepmothers and her half-brothers and half-sisters, and the uncles and aunts and cousins who had come from the furthest reaches of Zululand. Victoria had to make her farewells to all of them, though some partings were more poignant than others. One of these was her goodbye to Joseph Dinizulu, her favourite of all her relatives. Although he was a half-brother and 7 years younger than she was, a special bond had always existed between them. The two of them were the brightest and most gifted of their generation in the family, and because Joseph lived at Drake's farm with one of the elder brothers, they had been able to continue their friendship. However, Joseph would not be returning to the Witwatersrand. He had written the entrance exams and been accepted by the exclusive multiracial school Waterford in Swaziland, and Lady Anna Courtney would be paying his school fees. Ironically, this was the same school to which Hendrik Tabaka was sending his sons, Wellington and Raleigh. There would be opportunity for their rivalry to flourish. "Promise me that you will work hard, Joseph," Vicky said. "Learning makes a man strong." "I will be strong," Joseph assured her. The elation that Moses Garmer's speech had aroused in him still persisted. "Can I come and visit you and your husband, Vicky? He is a man, the kind of man I will want to be one day." Vicky told Moses what the child had said. They were alone in the old Buick, all the wedding gifts and Vicky's possessions filling the boot and piled in the back seat. And they were leaving that great, literal amphitheatre of Natal, going up over the tail of the Drakensberg Range, onto the high veld of the Transvaal. "The children are the future," Moses nodded, staring ahead at the steep blue serpent of road that climbed the escarpment, past the green hill of Majuba, where the Boers had thrashed the British in the first of many battles with them. "The old men are beyond hope. You saw them at the wedding, how they kicked and balked like unbroken oxen when I tried to show them the way. But the children..." "Ha! Ah, the children," he smiled. "They are like fresh, clean sheets of paper. You can write on them what you will. The old men are stone-hard and impermeable, but the children are clay, eager clay waiting for the shaping hands of the potter." He held up one of his hands. It was long and shapely, the hand of a surgeon or an artist, and the palm was a delicate shade of pink, smooth and not calloused by labour. "Children lack any sense of morality. They are without fear, and death is beyond their conception. These are all things they acquire later, by the teaching of their elders. They make perfect soldiers, for they question nothing, and it takes no great physical strength to pull a trigger. If an enemy strikes them down, they become the perfect martyrs. The bleeding corpse of a child strikes horror and remorse into even the hardest heart." "Yes, the children are our key to the future. Your Christ knew it when he said, 'Suffer the little children to come unto me.'" Victoria twisted on the leather bench seat of the Buick and stared at him. "Your words are cruel and blasphemous," she whispered, torn by her love for him and her instinctive rejection of what he had just said. "And yet your reaction proves their truth," he said. "But," she paused, reluctant to ask and fearful to hear his reply, "but are you saying that we should use our children?" She broke off, and an image of the pediatric section of the hospital came into her mind. She had spent the happiest months of all her training amongst the little ones. "Are you suggesting that you should use the children in the front line of the struggle? As soldiers? If a child cannot grow up a free man, then he might as well die as a child," Moses said. "Victoria, you have heard me say this before. It is time now that you learn to believe it. There is nothing I would not do, no price I would not pay for our victory. If I have to see 1,000 little children dead, so that 100,000 more may live to grow up free men, then for me the bargain is a fair one." Then, for the first time in her life, Victoria Dinizulu was truly afraid.